Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. Again, I'll be talking today with Donovan Chow, who's the author of Exploiting Africa, The Influence of Maoist China in Algeria, Ghana, and Tanzania. Donovan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Heath. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have read the book and to talk to you today. Before we get to the book, maybe you could talk just a little bit about yourself, where you are now and what some of your background is.
Sure. I'm currently an associate professor of political science at California State University, San Bernardino. And I have been studying and researching Africa, but particularly China and Africa, for a little over a decade now. In fact, I started the research when I was in England as a PhD student at the University of Reading, which is just west of London. And it really, this research is really a culmination of what I did many, many years ago and continue to follow very closely. And I care about what goes on in Africa, and I care about Asia. And so a lot of my research and even teaching focuses on politics in Africa, politics in Asia, but really the intersection of the two.
Now, how did you come to publish this with Naval Institute Press? This wasn't a publisher that I was familiar with, but they've designed and published your great book. So tell us, you know, just briefly about the publisher and how you came to work with them.
Sure. In fact, I was initially surprised that there was some interest on the part of the Naval Institute Press, and I'm more familiar with the Naval Institute's monthly publication proceedings, and so really I was exploring different publishers, and a personal contact of mine mentioned that actually the Naval Institute might be interested in my research on China and Africa, not simply because it's related to China, and the Naval Institute has actually published quite a bit on China's, not surprisingly, naval activities. But it seemed like they were interested in exploring some things beyond simply Chinese naval strategy. And so it was really through a personal contact, I must say, that I was introduced to one of the senior editors there. And it really was, I was really quite pleased working with the Naval Institute Press, and they're quite a professional group of people. And I value the press as well, because one of my mentors when I was an undergraduate student many, many years ago in the 1960s, he won an essay contest for the Naval Institute and for proceedings. And so I'm quite familiar with the Naval Institute in general, but in addition to the press, I value the types of things that they produce. Some of it is obviously more nautical and maritime history, naval history, military history, but I thought it was a good fit because my work is really a work of history, even though I myself am a political scientist.
Yeah, and yeah, I couldn't agree more. They've really, I think, reflected your hard work and your scholarship so well. So I think it's a press that I at least will keep my eye out for a little bit more for their, you know, some of the work that you've described and others in the political science realm. So let's talk about the book. You have a provocative title for the book. To frame this as exploitation suggests certain things. You didn't choose this title by accident. So what was your intention in naming the book as you did? And, you know, maybe how does this connect to your central argument of writing the book?
Sure. And it's an interesting and a difficult question, in fact, because this is, as you know, Heath, sometimes when the production of the book nears its completion, there's a back and forth that goes on between the editorial staff and the author. And so I was actually pushing for a title along the lines of using the word meddling as opposed to exploiting. And so I was convinced by the publisher that this was the best title. And it works for me in the sense that it is provocative, and it is really, it frames the discussion in such a way that makes one think about what was China doing in Africa in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And so I quite like the subtitle, the influence, that word, the influence of China. And so exploiting Africa, I won't say it was my first choice, but I think it worked. I think it worked.
Yeah. It's such an interesting backstory, and I think many authors probably have similar stories about how these aspects of the book that we probably don't think very much for the years and years and years that we're writing end up, you know, being so important. And it's mm-hmm. it's good that the change in title doesn't change the essential meaning of the book. I wanted to ask you, as a sort of a casual observer might assume about studying communist China. Might be that the historical documents would be difficult to get your hands on. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you conducted your research. You had just mentioned that you're a political scientist by training, but that you view much of this work as a history. So what was the method that you used to write your book?
Sure. Most of it was essentially historical archival research. And I mentioned that I studied at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom, and I was there, and then I actually moved back to the United States and did research in Washington, D.C., of all places, out of the Library of Congress. And the Library of Congress, as you know, is the world's largest public library, and their historical works, archival works on things such as the Peking Review, basically a lot of these communist Chinese publications, they quite extensive and exhaustive. And so I spent a lot of time doing archival research. And this was back in the day. I shouldn't even say that, but back in the day, a decade ago, when I was actually using microfiche. And I don't even know. I don't know if some of the younger colleagues nowadays, I don't even know if they know what that is, but it was quite a bit of fun going through various archival materials from communist China, as well as certain archival materials from Africa. And I also did a little bit of follow-up research a few years ago out of Northwestern University. There's a wonderful collection called the Herzkowitz Collection. It's an Africana collection. In fact, the world's largest Africana collection in the world. And it happens to be based at the Northwestern University over there in Evanston, Illinois.
Yeah, I think the rich details are a testament to this method that you've used in the book. So why these three countries, Algeria, Ghana, and Tanzania? They're geographically representative, different parts of the continent. But what else made each compelling to you? Were they particularly compelling to Maoist China, or do they serve some other purpose? Walk us through, real briefly, Algeria, Ghana, and Tanzania, who serve as the focus of the book.
Sure. There were a couple different considerations. First of all was the strategic consideration of China at the time, and their approach to Africa essentially followed the path that I, in the three case studies, starting in North Africa. And Algeria was a country the Algerian nationalist movement at the time in the 1950s was on the radar of the communist Chinese leadership. And so Algeria being a very, very important country strategically today, but at the time was actually the heart of the French colonial policy in Africa. And so to me, it made sense to look at this, at the Chinese in Algeria. Turning to West Africa in Ghana, that was also a very unique relationship. West Africa was quite a hotbed at the time of revolutionary national liberation movements. And as it turned out, and as you may have read in the book, the leader, Kwame Nkrumah, he became quite close and quite fond of communist China. And so that naturally became the focal point in West Africa. And then turning to Greater Eastern Africa, or East Africa, quite simply, Tanzania today, I would argue, and even back then, was considered a very, very strategically important country to China. And the amount of resources that China devoted into a project, maybe we'll talk more about in a little bit, but the Tanzania-Zambia Railway, that just speaks for itself. And so principally strategic considerations, but also looking at the chronology, that it flowed nicely. And not to say that the Chinese weren't active elsewhere. Certainly they were in Somalia, they were in Angola, Mozambique. They were in many different parts of the continent. But to me, these were quite representative of the way in which, that is to say, the nature and the character of what China was trying to.
Now, I'm going to focus on Ghana for mainly personal reasons that I've mentioned to you, my own fascination with Ghana. So tell us about why Ghana may have fascinated Chairman Mao and about China's somewhat bumpy relationship with Ghana.
Sure. I think there was actually mutual fascination on the part of the Chinese as well as the Ghanaians with one another. And a lot of it actually had to do with both of the country's leaders. And so Kwame Nkrumah and Mao Zedong, as you mentioned, Chairman Mao, they had visions of the world. And some of those visions, in fact, were congruent. Some of them were not. But one that really struck both Mao and Nkrumah was a vision of changing the African continent. And so, as you may know, Kwame Nkrumah, he had a vision. That vision really has come into fruition today in the form of the intergovernmental organization, the African Union. But he was really the person behind an Africa that was independent and united and could therefore act in international politics in such ways that would have more influence than if individual nation states acted. And so Mao was fascinated, and the communist leadership was fascinated with this individual, essentially the leader, and that was part of the problem. The focus was so much on this individual and his vision, and he was quite charismatic, obviously, as was Mao. And so there was also quite a bit of influence from Marxism, Leninism, that influenced Nkrumah. And so Mao was someone that he also was interested in and his writings. And he was a prolific writer, as most people know. Mao Zedong not only led communist China to defeat the nationalists in 1949, establishing China, but also really had a vision for China, which in many respects it still holds today, in the sense that he viewed China as desiring a rightful place in the world and having the type of influence that China should have, according to Mao's views. And so Nkrumah also emulated Mao in the sense that he wrote a handbook on revolutionary warfare, guerrilla warfare, and that was interesting to find at the Library of Congress, as well as at the Herskovitz Library. There were copies of this, actually a reprint of it, of what he wrote, and is essentially copying what Mao wrote on guerrilla warfare. And so there was mutual admiration. There was also some similar views of, in terms of strategic views of the world. And I think those naturally aligned. It didn't quite work out, because Kwame Nkrumah, he overlooked some of the domestic considerations. He was so concerned with helping these revolutionary movements outside of his country that he didn't really take care of business at home. And the Chinese, they hinted at that. They hinted at some policy changes that Nkrumah might consider. And unfortunately for him, he did not consider them until it was too late. And so that, I think, I hope that explains a little bit about that particular set of chapters, that case study of the Chinese in Africa, so Chinese in Ghana. And Ghana is really quite a unique country, as you know, in the sense that it really plays an outsized role in African politics, given its geographic size and population. And so the Chinese, they also recognize that. They recognize that Ghana might be an interesting place to lay some roots. And even though the relationship was severed for a time, as I spell out in my book today, the relationship is one of quite close mutual respect, admiration. And what's interesting, I'll note, Heath, that if you look at the official history of the Chinese in Ghana on the Chinese embassy website in Accra, one of the last times I looked, in fact, this whole period of time is sort of left out. That is the Maoist period of influence and how China was supporting revolutionary movements in Africa through Ghana. So that's interesting. It's not something that the Chinese would like to advertise today, since they're so active in many other respects. But this is part of a history, and it's one of the reasons why I was quite happy that I was able to include that case study in the book. And I hope not to necessarily expose some dirty laundry, but this is just part of the history. We all have histories, and it's important to understand this is a part of what China did in Africa, and in particular in Ghana.
Right. And so what are some of the differences between what drew China to Ghana in West Africa versus what drew it to Tanzania, thousands of miles away? What was the difference? Was the pull largely the same, or were there some peculiar aspects to the role that China could play in Tanzania that separated in some ways?
It's a great question, Heath, and I'll start by just focusing the listener's attention to geography. Geography is quite important to China, and their understanding of Africa in a strategic sense. They understand and study geography and history. And so one of the major considerations for the Chinese interest in Tanzania was quite simply because Tanzania is along the Indian Ocean. And so it's in Africa. One says that Tanzania is in Eastern Africa, but looking at the Indian Ocean, Tanzania, along with Kenya and Somalia and Mozambique and some of the insular island nations of Africa, they're in the Western Indian Ocean. And so considering long-term interests, the Chinese long-term interests, economic interests, as well as some other strategic considerations, it was important for China to have a solid foothold along the coastline of Eastern Africa, in other words, what the Western Indian Ocean, because at some point in time, the Chinese and the communist leadership and even Mao, who really understood the importance of economic development, the Chinese knew that they might need to have access to, for example, a usable port, have some friendly relations with countries along the coast in order to develop economic commercial ties into the interior of Africa. And a lot of what we see today, if I could just make a reference to the recent trip of the Chinese premier almost over 50 years later, after the premier that I reference in my book, Zhou Enlai, his visit of 10 African countries just recently last week, Premier Li Keqiang visited 4 African countries, and they included Ethiopia, Nigeria, Angola, and then Kenya. And so even though he didn't visit some of the countries I mentioned in my book, it really shows that Chinese understand what is strategically important in terms of location, but in terms of centers of political influence and even commercial and strategic interests influence.
So during this time period, and I will want to make clear that you're writing a specific time period. I don't know if we made that clear at the start, but you're writing of a specific set of years. What was the movement between these countries and China? And how did it take place? Are we talking mainly of, you know, exchanges of diplomats, or was the movement between these countries also involving other parts of the country, students, or what's the nature of the sort of the people exchange that went on during this time period?
Sure. It wasn't on a massive scale. So I'm glad you also made reference to the time period that I examine in the book, 1955 to 1976. There wasn't a massive exodus, if you will, of Chinese going to Africa or vice versa, and that was given the nature of international transportation and international lines of communication at the time. So there were, what the Chinese began doing in the 50s, they sent journalists and they sent some cultural and quasi-diplomatic troops to explore Africa and to present Chinese culture, but also to report on what was going on in Africa, in these countries, back to China. And so what there was is an interesting, I'll say just a parallel, I won't say correlation, but an interesting parallel, wherever there were journalists from the Chinese government news agency, the New China News Agency, or now called Xinhua, wherever they went, later on, that's where China developed diplomatic relations, because China did not have diplomatic relations with many of the newly emerging African countries, because China, as you know, China after 1949 wasn't internationally recognized as the legitimate representative of China in international politics. In fact, that label was being held by the Republic of China on Taiwan. So that was part of the reason, and I argue in the book that was really a secondary reason why the Chinese were in Africa. But that was one of the ways in which China developed ties, sending in journalists, cultural troops. Eventually, the Chinese began to invite Africans to China to study. And I don't go into that in great detail. That's an interesting subject in itself. These Africans that were in China in the 60s and 70s, and some of the works that I came across written by Africans who had spent some time in China during that period of time, they weren't necessarily favorable of China, along the lines of how Africans today who go to China, they have much more favorable views. And I'll speak just a quick aside to an individual I met when I was in Kenya several years ago. He was a Tanzanian military officer, and we were talking. I was telling him about the research I was doing. We were sitting resort side in Mombasa, enjoying ourselves outside, and we were talking about China, and then he mentioned how he spent a year in China, and he had quite favorable views of Chinese society and culture and the like. And to me, that was interesting to hear that the influence and the time and the energy and the effort that the Chinese put in so long ago in a place like Tanzania, that is beginning to have some payoffs. And that leads to an interesting view of China and how China views the world, and in the sense that China views things on a different scale. I haven't really written about it. I probably should, but I call it the China scale, and China views things not in terms of time, not in terms of 5 years, 10 years, but more along the lines of 20 years, 50, 100 years. And that is a different way of viewing the world and international politics. And so I try to hint at some of this in the book. I try to hint at this. This was just the initial period of time that China spent time in Africa, and it was really a commitment for the long term.
Yeah, and I guess that really does beg a question. You've been also hinting at this throughout much of what you've said, which is, you know, the continuity till today. You know, in so many ways, we think of the relationship of China to the world as so very different now. The ruling party has changed in some fundamental way that it permits it to participate in world events in a way that it didn't 50 odd years ago. So it does beg the question, is the involvement today a continuation, or is it something very different? Is it motivated by the same ideas that Mao had, or is the newer regimes pursuing a different strategy?
It's a great question, Heath, and my argument is that there is more continuity than change. Certainly the China of the 21st century, quite different than the China of the mid-20th century. The ideological rhetoric of Mao and Maoism isn't prominent, although there are strains of it still within communist China and within China today and within the Communist Party today. But fundamentally, I argue, and I hope the reader might get a sense of this from my book, that there is continuity in the approach, the strategic approach, in terms of the types of objectives that China has today, which is essentially to become a economically strong and prosperous and socially unified country and have influence in the world. Those are the same goals that China had in the mid 20th century. And today, certainly one could say the toolkit or the tool basket of China is much bigger, much more money to contribute and to Africa compared to in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. But I believe that the fundamental nature of the Chinese in Africa is very much the same. And in an odd way, in fact, the communist leaders in China today, even Premier Li Keqiang, who just returned from Kenya, signing a massive rail infrastructure deal with many of the leaders in East Africa. He just returned to China. In many respects, the references to history and shared bonds of the past, that in fact reaffirms, at least to me and my analysis, is that there is more continuity, and the Chinese view that history as important and fundamental to moving forward into the 21st century. And so while the Chinese have so many more resources and means to influence, and not in a necessarily in a negative way, but to influence Africa than in the Maoist period, there is, in my analysis, more continuity.
It's I enjoyed the book just so much. This is an area that interests me, and I've read about it from some different angles, but not from the angle that you've chosen in the book. And so I can recommend the book for those that are interested in either China or the various countries of Africa, but also in the in international relations in general. I think it's just such an interesting book. Tadava, what's up next for you? You've hinted again at some possible new directions, but what is on your agenda now? Are you continuing in this vein, or is there something else that we can expect from you?
I appreciate the question very much, because currently I'm on a quarter long sabbatical, so I really should be figuring this out. But
right.
My heart is certainly, I've said it in so many of my classes, and I say it to my African friends in different parts of the continent, my heart is really in Africa. And so my my longer term research plans are to focus more on Africa than necessarily China, but that there's so much more, in my opinion, that needs to be explored both historically, but also in terms of more contemporary research in terms of the Chinese. And so I'm interested in, for example, looking at how some of these leaders in the early African independence leaders, how did they view China? And so I have some aspirations, at least, to explore that. And but also in a more contemporary vein, looking at some of the unique ways that China may be influencing Africa, for example, through the provision of information and communications technology, and essentially how Africa might be brought into the 21st century cyberspace world. How is China contributing to that? And so those are some tentative research, longer term research plans, but it really, a lot of my passion really lies in Africa, and I just, it's so diverse, so interesting, and you, as we see in today's current affairs, is so important to understand, and so that's sort of where I'm leaning, but I am open to other avenues of research downrange, so to speak, but that's a little bit of what I think I have in store in the future. But I really appreciate your kind words about my book, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's really, as you know, doing this type of research and writing is a labor of love, but this is, I have so much of my heart in this research, and it means a lot to me that someone like yourself enjoyed it, and I'm very happy that we're able to talk about it, my book.
Yeah, well, I can only hope that some additional people listen to you talk about the book and go out and read the book. I think that it's worthy of adding to everyone's summer reading list. Donovan's book is titled Exploiting Africa, The Influence of Maoist China in Algeria, Ghana, and Tanzania. As we mentioned at the start, it's published by Naval Institute Press this year, available at their website, I'm sure, as well as Amazon. Donovan, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Heath. I enjoyed our conversation.